Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
What the gender pay gap means for the global economy, and how do you explain the racial wealth gap to kids? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, March 6th. Good to have you with us. Here in the nation's capital, we are settling in for quite the week of economic news. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, will testify before Congress tomorrow and Wednesday, likely fielding questions about where this economy is headed and when inflation might finally ease up. On Thursday, President Biden is set to release his budget outline for the coming fiscal year. And for the data nerds, of course, we get the jobs numbers for February this Friday. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us started.
If you nerd out on economics, like, let's face it, we do at Marketplace, it doesn't get much better than this. And the best is saved for last, the jobs report on Friday.
I'm optimistic we'll have a good report Friday, but maybe not as surprisingly hot as it was in the January report.
That's Yana Rogers, an economist at Rutgers University. She says the pent-up demand for workers is hitting the brick wall of the Fed's higher interest rates. She says higher borrowing costs are a constraint for companies.
And when companies are constrained, they have to cut back somewhere else, and it could be with new jobs, new hiring.
Fed Chair Jerome Powell will read every word of the Friday jobs report, but first he'll face some scrutiny on Capitol Hill. Patrick Horan, a research fellow at George Mason University, thinks Powell will be asked why the Fed is losing money. Horan says the Fed is getting a low rate of return on the bonds it bought to shore up the economy during the pandemic. So
now its liabilities are much larger than the revenue that it's taking in, and that's why it's costing the Fed so much.
Horan says Powell might also be asked about the congressional tussle over raising or suspending the debt limit, setting the stage for Thursday's release of President Biden's budget outline.
The budget will serve as kickoff to the debt ceiling debate.
Henrietta Trays is managing partner at Veda Partners. She says the president's budget is really just a wish list. Congress has the purse strings. But Trays says President Biden will try to narrow the budget deficit with new taxes on corporations and wealthy taxpayers.
Traditional components of that tax policy are what allows him to reduce the deficit and then also spend on things like clean energy, education.
Republicans have floated their own ideas, like capping some government spending at fiscal 2022 levels. You'll hear lots more about all this with many more hearings to come. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, investors are waiting on all that economic news, just like the rest of us. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It being Women's History Month and all, Moody's Analytics has a new report out about the gender pay gap, and the numbers are pretty astonishing. Moody's says that $7 trillion a year could be added to the global economy if there were more women in the workforce and they faced fewer roadblocks to their career growth. Just closing that gap in developed economies would raise global economic activity by about 7%, even more if you get the rest of the world on board. In other words, closing the gender gap wouldn't just benefit individual women. As Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, it would also benefit everyone.
24-year-old Maria Malikzada studied law and political science at a university in Kandahar province in Afghanistan until December, when the Taliban banned women from universities. She's had to defer her dream of becoming a lawyer and representing other women.
I wanted to become their voices in Kandahar. But now I need someone to work for me and raise my voice.
She's also had to defer her dream of more money. She works from home for an NGO, but she's worried that work won't last. Afghanistan offers some of the most extreme examples of the barriers that exist to women fulfilling their potential. Don Holland with Moody's Analytics, one of the authors of the new report, says women around the world are having a hard time getting into positions with more authority.
There's this large pool of well-educated women ready to step into these positions.
Holland found that if there were more women in the workforce and fewer roadblocks to their career growth, the global economy would grow by at least 7%, and that'd be massive.
Economic growth matters because it raises our average living standards. If you're raising the average living standards of women, single mothers in particular, you're also addressing some issues of inequalities.
The research says there are things that can help, from giving women educational opportunities to providing paid maternity and paternity leave and lowering the cost of childcare. But Holland notes the patriarchy makes all of that really hard.
Essentially, it's deeply embedded into our social norms, which makes it extremely difficult to shift.
That's something 43-year-old Ana Maria Diaz knows firsthand. She was a freelance stylist in the fashion industry in New York, loving it despite the grueling hours, but not earning enough to cover childcare for her two kids.
I think nobody really talks about what the first maybe 4 years of childcare really cost.
She ended up leaving her career, and now her household's down to one income. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
While we're on the topic of the labor force, there's something of a shift going on in the trucking industry. As U.S.-born drivers retire and demand to move freight remains high, American trucking is increasingly becoming an immigrant-driven industry. The number of foreign-born truck drivers in the U.S. has more than doubled since the year 2000. In Houston, which sits on a major shipping corridor, the industry's demographic shifts are especially pronounced. That's where Houston Chronicle's Elizabeth Troval picks up the story.
On a sunny morning outside Jetco Trucking Company headquarters, a massive big rig rumbles through an industrial lot in North Houston. But there's a lot of trucks just sitting around.
We've probably got 18 or 20 of our own trucks sitting out there that we need to get filled.
That's Jetco President Kyle Kristenick. He says it's not a lack of cargo that's keeping these trucks parked. It's that there's not enough people to drive them.
Based on the demand of our clients right now, I could have another 50 drivers right now easily.
Even as wages have crept up, the trucking industry continues to face a worker shortage as career drivers retire and shipping demand stays high. Being a trucker can be tough. And like many trades, it doesn't attract U.S.-born workers like it used to. The hours are long, and median pay is around $48,000 a year, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So many companies have relied on people like Jorge Chavez, who came to the U.S. as a teen and is now a second-generation trucker.
Well, my mom, she was a truck driver in Central America.
Chavez says as a kid, his mom, a single parent, would take him on international trucking jobs.
She drove from El Salvador to Costa Rica, Honduras, with my brother and I.
It was a way to keep the family together. They would camp, grill, sing, and she would say,
"Guys, I'm doing this because I love you. I want you to grow up, and I'm teaching you something."
But for Chavez, driving isn't just a labor of love. He's worked his way up and now owns and operates two trucks of his own for Jetco. For him, the money is good.
You can do about $12,000 per month after everything.
Chavez says he's seen a lot of Central Americans become drivers since he got into trucking 20 years ago. In that time, the number of foreign-born truck drivers has tripled in Texas to nearly 95,000 people. That's a quarter of the state's truckers, according to American Immigration Council analysis of government data.
I talked to a lot of company owners that actively recruit in other countries.
Texas Trucking Association President John Esparza.
There is an avenue to come to this country and make a really good living in trucking.
Many of the truck drivers in Houston are refugees and migrants from countries like Afghanistan, Eritrea, and Cuba, who have started their own small trucking businesses. But Esparza says there should be more legal pathways to hire drivers from abroad.
There's frankly room to have a special visa just for trucking.
He also says it should be easier to get work permits for the millions of undocumented people living in the country today, many of whom could become career drivers.
You got people that want to work here, and we need the labor.
While the industry may have the appetite for immigration reform, Congress, not so much. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Coming up,
induction really is heating up.
Just couldn't resist that one. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 40 points, 0.1%, to finish at 33,431. The NASDAQ lost 13 points, 0.1%, to close at 11,675. And the S&P 500 added 2 points to end essentially flat at 4048. A 2022 survey by NYU and the Family Travel Association found that 85% of parents were likely or very likely to travel with children in the next 12 months. And there's a new dashboard from the Department of Transportation to make it easier to see which airlines will let you sit with your kids for no extra fee. So far, that's American Airlines, Frontier, and Alaska Airlines, which fell 1.1% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.97%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. All over the country, a battle is happening over how we teach our country's history, especially when it comes to race. And for our purposes, the key role racial discrimination has played in the American economy. Last year, I spoke to Heather McGee about her book dealing with just that. It's called The Sum of Us: What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. In it, McGee lays out how racism shaped what kind of social safety net and public goods we do and don't have access to today. Now, in the midst of the current backlash, she's releasing a new version of the book, adapted for younger readers. Heather McGee joins me again now. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
The title of the book, The Sum of Us, reflects this idea that you really unpack in the book, where some people see racism as a zero-sum game. Can you just explain that idea again?
Yeah, it's a very common worldview in the U.S. It's this idea that there's sort of a fixed pie of well-being. And if one racial and ethnic group gets a bigger slice, then the other groups must get a smaller slice. Black folks, brown folks, generally speaking, don't tend to think that our progress as people of color has to come at white folks' expense. But according to the data, the opposite isn't true. And so it's this zero-sum thinking that makes us often at odds with one another when we would all be better off if we were looking for common solutions to our common problems.
Your original book focused on how racism shaped the public goods we enjoy in this country today. There's a ton in there about the economy, politics, as well as the violence involved in some of these policy shifts over time. How did you think about adapting some of these very heavy themes for a younger audience?
Well, as I talked to young people about this idea, the number one thing that I heard from them was, don't dumb it down. We're young, but we're not stupid. know, which honestly was a learning for me. I don't at all, you know, pull any punches about how terrible slavery was, but I focus on the part that they might not get anywhere other than this book, which is the economic parts of slavery, because this is our history. It's our shared history. And so many adults have told me they were outraged that they didn't know. And I don't want another generation to grow up in that ignorance.
What have you been hearing from parents and teachers so far about the adaptation, or even from young readers themselves?
Well, you know, it's been fascinating and fun. My book tour for this book is taking me into schools and libraries and talking to educators and librarians and parents. And one thing they have said, you know, it feels very relevant to them, and it helps explain some of the things that just kind of make no sense, right? Why do we have college priced out of reach when it's the ticket to the middle class, you know, and when it's what everything in society tells us to do? And so there's some of this explaining some of the most sort of inexplicable ways in which this country is kind of hamstringing itself.
You know, you just mentioned that you're going into schools and libraries, but all over the country, books and curricula about America's history of racism are being limited or sometimes outright banned. What kind of effect do you expect this trend to have on the reach of your book?
You know, obviously, the thought has crossed my mind, but I think what's exciting about this movement, which frankly, these book bans are an attempt to stop, this movement that has had so many more people, white, black, and brown, curious about our history and willing to look at the many, many aspects of systemic racism, is that once you know how bad it was, you can find other heroes to celebrate. You know, you can look at the young white students in the Freedom Summer who went down to Mississippi and opened up freedom schools and registered people to vote and think, God, they did that against the odds, against death threats. And it's even more amazing when you understand the totality of the forces that were arrayed against them. So I think there's plenty to be proud of. We don't need to ban this history in order to protect white students' feelings. That's certainly not what I'm hearing when I'm out on the road talking to white students in schools and libraries across the country.
Have you heard about your book being banned anywhere?
Not yet. Not yet. I mean, what am I going to say? You know, it's only been out for a little bit. But, you know, the book has, I think, a message that should scare many of the people who are using these book bans as a partisan strategy. And ultimately, I think that the goal is to attack public funding. So like so much of strategic racism in our politics, there's ultimately an economic goal at the end.
Given what you've learned adapting this book for a younger audience, what tips would you have for parents when they are trying to talk to their kids about this stuff?
That's a great question. You know, I think ultimately, try to really make it rooted in the context of your young person's own life. Schools, the issue of the cost of college, climate change, guns, right? These are issues that actually, if you peel back the onion, there's a real racial story involved. And it helps make a little bit of sense of some of the dysfunction that seems honestly kind of impossible to justify. But when you realize that so much of our dysfunction comes from our unwillingness across racial lines to come together, then it begins to make more sense. And then honestly, there's even more energy for creating the kinds of cross-racial coalitions that are the real key to having breakthroughs in the interest of most working families.
Heather McGee's new book is a young reader's version of The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In addition to the fights over books we're apparently having in this country, another flashpoint in the culture wars was sparked earlier this year over cooking with natural gas. The Biden administration is trying to nudge the transition to cleaner cooking by launching a federal rebate for the purchase of electric appliances and possibly strengthening efficiency standards for new gas stoves. Most Americans already cook with electric stoves, by the way. But what about induction? That technology uses a copper coil and electromagnetism to heat pots and pans rather than traditional heating, which is indirect radiation, if you want to be technical about it. Induction stoves haven't had much traction, but Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports some manufacturers are hoping this could be the moment for that market to heat up.
Nick Troutman is a fairly serious home chef.
I enjoy cooking. I follow a bunch of social media accounts. This recipe is coming from a TikTok.
Season your chicken thighs with lemon pepper and cook both sides in some oil. Ooh. Remove from the pan and cook some garlic.
When it's time to boil water for the orzo, he's excited to show me how fast his induction cooktop can do it. I break out my iPhone stopwatch.
Okay, count me down.
3, 2, 1.
We see some lazy bubbles coming up around a minute, and then about 30 seconds later...
I would call that a boil. Pretty cool.
It's a really fun party trick.
When Nick and his partner Meredith bought their house in Albuquerque, they hoped to replace the ancient electric coil range with a gas stove.
Because it's what we knew growing up. It seemed the most respectable. It's the most fun.
But it turned out installing a gas line was going to cost something like $2,000.
It was a whole big thing. And instead, some guy said, hey, try induction.
That guy being a salesperson at an appliance wholesaler.
We just thought that originally this would be electric 2.0. It sounded awful.
And the induction models were a little more expensive than traditional electric. But that salesperson hit Nick and Meredith with the speedy water boiling trick.
It's a good sell.
And now he, too, can boil water in under 2 minutes. Recently, retailers have been giving induction stoves more showroom space, and that's helping win over skeptics.
Induction really is heating up,
so to speak. Jill Notini is with the Association of Home Appliance Manufacturers. For the last few years, she says induction sales have grown an average of 3%.
But it's still a very small piece of the overall electric market, representing about 5%.
With possible restrictions on gas stoves looming, Notini says manufacturers are ramping up production of induction ranges and cooktops. But there are reasons the technology hasn't gained much traction, even though it's been around since the 70s. For one,
for many years, people thought that they needed to have special pots and pans in order to work with induction.
You do need magnetic cookware, like stainless steel or cast iron. If you can't part with your ceramic Dutch oven, induction might not be for you. And Notini says another hurdle is home electrification.
It is possible in some situations that you would need to upgrade your electric panel in order to accommodate the amperage.
Especially in very old homes, and rewiring can be prohibitively expensive. A couple of startups are working on that problem, like Impulse Labs in San Francisco.
We were thinking about ways to, cook pizza really fast.
Founder Sam D'Amico was looking to revolutionize home cooking appliances.
And realized if you could integrate a battery pack in there, then you can essentially decouple the performance of the appliance from, what power source you might have from the wall.
Impulse is developing an induction cooktop that runs partially on battery power. D'Amico plans to launch within the year, but he says the industry also faces a marketing problem that's much squishier.
There is a ritual aspect of cooking and meals.
D'Amico says a lot of home cooks were emotionally attached to cooking with fire, even before it got political.
When you're trying to rock the boat on something kind of so basic to the human experience, it's like you're coming up against social pressures that may not even be put into words.
It doesn't have the same romance to it.
In his Albuquerque kitchen, Nick Troutman says he sometimes misses the experience of cooking with a little blue flame. But functionally, he says induction produces the same results, if not better.
The only single thing is you can't roast marshmallows.
And he has a dedicated heat gun for that anyway. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, also dessert related. It turns out chocolate can have an identity crisis. According to Business Insider, the triangular Swiss chocolate bar Toblerone just isn't quite Swiss enough anymore. The American company that owns the brand is moving some of the production of the candy bar to Slovakia, meaning it will no longer meet Switzerland's definition of Swissness, which requires 80 to 100% of raw materials for a product to be from Switzerland in order to carry the Made in Switzerland label or to use iconic Swiss imagery like the image of the Matterhorn on the Toblerone packaging, which now has to go. Here's your moment of economic context, which comes our way from Axios. You know how we've been saying the last couple of weeks that despite the Fed's rate hikes, consumer spending just does not seem to be slowing down the way economists expected? Well, Bank of America says we can blame baby boomers, at least partially. This year, Social Security beneficiaries received the largest cost of living adjustment in more than 40 years, an 8.7% boost due to inflation. That seems to have translated into higher credit card spending for boomers and Gen Xers compared to other age groups. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.